Welcome to episode 8 of All the Small Takes. We're back in our usual Sunday slot this week, and I am joined, as usual, by John and Cooper. Quick shout out to John's Mississippi State Lady Bulldogs.
Yeah, they took down UConn. They ended the 111 game winning streak despite the referees attempting to collude with Gino Auriemma and UConn to help them out there. But shout out once again to the Lady Bulldogs. They're playing tonight. Hopefully they win the title. And shout out to my little sister, once again, a civil engineer at Mississippi State in Starkville. Go Dogs. Hashtag Cal State.
Cooper, how are you?
Pretty good. Not clinging on to a team that I don't actually support. So
what is that supposed to mean?
What?
I have 4 Mississippi State shirts. I am a Mississippi State supporter.
Okay.
Well, thank you guys for joining us again this week. Quickly, you can find us on social media and let you know what you think of this week and any other weeks. If you have any suggestions, comments, questions. Instagram, small_takes. Twitter, @smalltakes. Facebook, allthesmalltakes. And Gmail, allthesmalltakes@gmail.com. It's opening day as we are recording this. And this means baseball will be on for the next 6 months nonstop. Cooper, how excited are you for that?
Super. Just super excited.
I can feel it. So we've given our predictions for the baseball season a couple episodes ago. And this week instead, I think John has some rule changes. Rule changes are kind of a hot topic in baseball right now. There's lots of conversation about pace of play and shortening games. And John, I think, has some more, you might say, out there suggestions. So how can baseball be, as you say, made great again?
Well, those are your words, not mine here, Jeff.
It's in the Google Doc is your words. Let the record show.
Maybe we'll cut that. Leading off, you know, I think baseball during the Bud Selig era has become a little not as great as it used to be. It's become, in a word, hyper-consumerized. But that's neither here nor there at the moment. Let's talk about some rules that we think might make baseball fun and exciting again.
Everyone drink. Johnson has consumerism.
The first one is one I'm not totally sure about, which I'll explain after you guys jump in on it, is kill the DH rule. There's an argument that it's silly that one of the leagues doesn't make their pitchers come up and bat like every other baseball player has to. So maybe we should just get rid of the designated hitter rule and make the American League pitchers man up and hit the ball.
I'm going to disagree with you on the DH rule. I'm a fan, and I think this maybe is telling the fact that you're a fan of a National League team and I'm a fan of an American League team. But I enjoy seeing hitters hit and pitchers pitch, and I don't think there's anything wrong with having a rule that doesn't force someone whose specialty is pitching to do something that's not their specialty. Like, I like seeing runs, and I like seeing pitchers be able to pitch as long as they should be able to pitch, not as determined by, oh, there's spots coming up in the lineup and he's a 150 hitter. Like, what? It doesn't make sense.
Well, I mean, you know, there's an argument, Jeff, that by forcing the pitchers to only pitch and by forcing the batters to only bat, that baseball's becoming a microcosm of society at large, where, you know, we're telling everybody to just go to their corners and not to dialogue, not to share their common experiences and to try to engage with each other. And I think we should avoid that, especially in baseball, which is, you know, America's pastime.
So you're calling it partisan politics, pitchers and hitters.
I'm not, but I mean, you did, so.
No, I like the DH rule. It gives the best the opportunity to do what they do and only that. Do you have other suggestions, John?
I do. So the next one kind of goes in a different vein than killing the DH rule. I'm not totally convinced we should kill the DH rule. I like the fact that there's like a quirk between the two leagues, that they are actually different. Unlike in every other major sports league that's divided up in half, you know, it actually means something different to be an American League team than a National League team. And I like that. And I think actually that we should encourage that we should encourage the two leagues to sort of diversify and maybe experiment with rules that they enjoy playing with that maybe the American League or the National League doesn't want to play with. And to that end, I think we should totally eliminate interleague play. It's bizarre now. This is part of something that we're going to get onto in a second. But having all this interleague play makes, you know, opening day weird, first off, where...
Yeah, the Red Sox open you know, tomorrow against the Pirates, which is... makes zero sense.
Yeah, it's bizarre. And like you have all these interleague games that affect who wins the National League and who wins the American League pennants. And I think it's silly. And I think there's something special about the World Series where the two leagues finally play and each team has to play with the other league's rules when they're in their ballpark. And I love that. And I think that gets watered down by having all this interleague play throughout the year.
There definitely, I'll agree with you more so on this one. There's been too much of it. And it all comes down to probably, I would have to think, the money. And like, you get the opportunity to bring in like teams that your fans wouldn't usually get to see. Like if you're a Royals fan and the Cubs come to town, like that's a better draw just financially than another division game against the Twins, you know? So I think, yeah. I have to think that's probably the root of it. And I don't know if it's for the best of the game, to your point.
I think it also makes the All-Star game a lot more fun, because then there's these two times throughout the year where National League players and American League players actually meet up, and it's the All-Star game in the World Series. I think that, you know, there'd be something fun, something special about that. You know, you'd have greater league cohesiveness, because this is a great tradition in baseball that we don't really have in any of the other major sports, is leagues and like the old league presidents and things that Bud Selig killed. So, you know.
Cooper, do you have any thoughts? Noticeably silent on your end.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I just keep on thinking about how John might appreciate that I'm definitely not a consumer of baseball. And it's hard for me to really think about either of these rules actually making the game more entertaining for spectators like me who do not really enjoy sitting at home watching baseball. Now, going to the ballpark and all that stuff and, you know, getting to watch a baseball game in person is a completely different story. And that's something that I really do enjoy. But I still don't find either of these suggested rule changes enticing me to actually turn on the TV and watch a baseball game for a couple of hours.
So what would?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to like think of them other than like maybe putting a slip and slide in between bases, or like having infielders and base runners wear giant pads so they can like tackle each other.
Oh my God, you're such a football fan.
Concussions? Is that what you want, Cooper? Would that make baseball more exciting?
Maybe.
Oh gosh, maybe?
No, but in reality, I do think they need to like, I think the like anti kind of like bat flip thing stance that like is kind of like being thrown around by a lot of like Major League Baseball pundits and kind of things like that. I think like just allowing bat flips, allowing celebrations, allowing a little bit more fun, I think would help. I think baseball is kind of like stuck in a culture that's like a little bit behind, unlike the NBA, who also like is not like the NFL. I think the NBA is kind of like fights an uphill battle in terms of entertainment, but I think like they've shown what can happen when you kind of embrace like current, like the culture of your, definitely the culture of your players, and kind of like the culture of your fans.
I agree with that. And I think,
yeah.
So I like, there's all these rule changes that are talked about with pitch clocks and with that. Now this year they're eliminating the intentional walk, and those things are harming the fundamental principles of the game, when in actuality, if you just took out some of the unwritten rules, if you encouraged players to show passion and you didn't have not only pundits, but players themselves, like Ian Kinsler in the World Baseball Classic took a shot at the Puerto Rican team. And he said that, I just know, like he said something along the lines of like, that's not how we were taught to play, good for them. But and it was just kind of like a sign that that mentality, even as you have these younger players coming into the game, is very much still like has its grips on how Major League Baseball is played. If there was just a gradual, like tiny move towards, and I think there has been a little bit, but you still see some resistance towards more fun and more expression, it would do a lot to attract younger fans to the game and to play the game, which is a huge issue right now for baseball. Like kids are not playing baseball and kids are playing basketball. It's a perfect point of how basketball has done a great job of marketing itself to an audience, and baseball has continued to market to an audience that's old and set in its ways a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think they need to encourage celebrations or encourage any gimmicky things, but I do think that they need to encourage the players to be who they are.
Yes.
Because that's part of what makes basketball, like the NBA, so exciting, is they build up these storylines in ways that the NFL doesn't, Major League Baseball doesn't, about individual players. And then the players themselves are so fluent on social media, and they each have all these individual brands, and there's all these other things. But I think that would be huge. Just embracing an ethic of personality for baseball.
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to think like really outside of Bryce Harper, like other players who have kind of a personality or like they're kind of their own brand outside of the sport of baseball.
I don't know if it needs to be a brand outside of baseball. I think there are players, like I do have hope that the game is kind of shifting this way. And there's a lot of young players who are let their personalities come through. Like Javi Baez for the Cubs is a great example. Like that guy plays the game with so much flair and so much pizzazz, and he's really, really good. And I'd like to think, like another, like Francisco Lindor for the Indians is another young guy, and those are two really up and coming players in baseball. And I'd like to think that they are going to be part of ushering in a much more accepting attitude of their style of play.
So I also had killing the divisions in here, which kind of gets back at the league thing. I think it's, if we couple this ethic of personalities with the old 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s lore of the pennant races, just the old stories and the poetry that went into those, it could be amazing for baseball. So
to be clear, you're suggesting
the divisions.
Yeah, no divisions, and then pennant winners go right to the World Series. Like, that's a lot of money left on the table.
Well, I mean, we could always just add, 30 more games onto the season. That's fine.
Solve so many problems. I don't, you're absolutely right.
I don't think anyone would notice.
I don't know. I will say that the only time I really tune into baseball is like October. So
yeah, you can't take that away at this point.
I don't think we can completely take the postseason away.
Yeah, I know. You could still have wild cards to make it in, but I think the divisions are just sort of artificial, and it makes sense to have an American League and a National League and not just one huge clump because they play by different rules. But inside the leagues themselves, it doesn't make as much sense, especially now where it's not a regional sport, it's a national sport, and where, you know, the Phillies are in the East and they're playing Miami and Atlanta for basically, like a quarter of their schedule because you play your division so often. When you have teams like the Pirates that are so close, and you have it would make more sense to just have a one league where you play everybody and you just have one person that gets a pennant at the end, but then other people can get in the postseason.
Like an actual physical pennant, like here you go.
Yes, like I want the physical pennants back, though. Like,
I think actually the playoffs is one of the things that Major League Baseball does really, really well. Calling back to a discussion we had a few podcasts ago about postseasons.
I like the playoffs.
Yeah.
We can still have the playoffs. Like people can get wild cards. I'm just saying for the regular season, we need the pennant winner. We need the league winner. And then you have the league winner and then four wild cards. And they play the other side.
Yeah, it's kind of, you're getting about the same, like you're going to end up with the same kind of thing. It's just different names for the same thing, I think.
Well, no one gets to, people don't get to hang a band for winning the National League East anymore. That's the difference. All right, the last one is, of course, which is I think probably the best idea, and it's certainly the one that's closest to home for me, and that's relegation. I love the idea that the Biloxi Shuckers, my hometown team, could someday, if someone was willing to spend enough money and invest enough time and effort, work their way up to the major leagues, or the New Orleans Zephyrs, or the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp, or the Toledo Mud Hens, or the Indianapolis Indians, or the Montgomery Biscuits. I mean, all these great teams that can someday be Major League Baseball teams if relegation were a thing.
Minor league team mascots are a treasure, by the way, just as a side note, like an absolute treasure.
Oh, they're the best.
That was pretty impressive how many you were able to rattle off there too. But
yeah, kudos.
You guys have always been on the relegation train, the relegation bandwagon, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for the idea of teams, of regional teams, not necessarily major teams, being able to get a chunk of the action every once in a while.
Yeah, I think plus from like a quality perspective, I think it does more. I mean, it kind of adds to the just like bucket of incentives that you have to try and win. I don't know how much it would really affect baseball, I guess. But I mean, like definitely in other sports, we see teams trying to lose for draft picks. And, you know, like that would no longer be like a viable strategy.
Well, baseball's big into the hard rebuild.
Yeah, it happens a lot. I mean, the Astros.
That's true. Yeah.
The Sixers rebuild was really a baseball rebuild where they just they sold people off and tried to get picks and stuff. And actually, and so like a nuance on that, I saw a couple, maybe about a month or so ago, was introducing the idea of the loan system to baseball, where at the All-Star break, a team who was out of contention could loan one of their players to another team, but they would get a prospect back. They would keep the prospect, but then the guy would come back to their team at the end of the year.
Is that how loans work in international soccer? This might be a dumb question.
No, not well, always. I mean, sometimes no. Loans are just like you loan, like a big club might loan off one of their young players just because they know that young player is not going to crack their starting 11. It's more of a like way to develop players.
Yeah. Hmm. I'd be more on board for that than relegation.
Yeah, I think relegation with baseball would definitely be tricky. Like how you would work out the farm system, like affiliates and all that stuff.
Well, if you expanded the roster by say, I don't know, 10 guys, and you gave them 4 years to phase out their minor league system.
Yeah,
maybe. Because no, like, big prospect spends 4 years in the minors working his way up. Most of that, like, by that, like, no, there's no one who's going to surprise you after 4 years. Like,
yeah, but I think kind of a big difference, though, is in soccer, in the world, like, soccer, you have youth academies. So, like, there's still that way to develop young talent. And if... I guess the farm system isn't in place in baseball. I don't really know how that would happen.
In Spain, they actually some of the bigger clubs actually have smaller clubs directly affiliated with them in the lower leagues.
Yeah,
and they just never advance. But anyway, yeah, potential rule changes.
Well, I will look forward to more baseball discussion because now, as we've mentioned, especially once we get through like NBA and NHL postseason, boys, all we got is baseball. Buckle up. Going to be a good time, but we will now move ahead into a few segments. Going to actually, speaking of looking ahead past baseball, these guys are so desperate for something other than Major League Baseball that they brought up college football on April 2nd.
Hey, spring game for yesterday.
I like baseball. All right. I'm a baseball fan. I don't live near enough to the Phillies to. And
spring games were yesterday. I mean, I think like it's at least somewhat relevant.
It's coming from the same people who made fun of me for citing spring training stats like a month ago. Like we're talking about football spring games.
That's because spring training stats don't matter. Come on, Jeff.
Oh, and in college,
everyone knows the spring game is relevant.
Absolutely, Matt. Yep, you're right. But I'm here for college football too. I'm on board, and so we are going to do a couple of college football related segments. This is the first time we've really talked college football on this podcast, so we're kind of excited. We're all pretty big fans. And the first segment we're going to do is the Fire Four, which you've heard us do before. But this time we are going to do the Fire Four of college football coaches. And John, do you want to explain the qualifier you put on this? Because I don't think
I can. Well, it's Cooper's qualifier.
I have no idea what it means.
You came up with the metric a couple of weeks ago when we filmed, when I was back home over spring break. We got into like a rabbit trail about mentally tough. And what it means to be a mentally tough college football coach. And so I figured it would be appropriate to throw that on here since you think that's the epitome of a college football coach.
I don't know if it's the
epitome. Someone who's mentally tough.
I'm also not really sure what I meant it as. What do you mean it as?
I mean, who doesn't necessarily fake heart attack and then go eat pizza on a golf cart after a football game.
Okay, so that rules out my number two.
Yeah, that was an oddly specific qualification. Yeah.
It's almost like he had looked at the Google Doc.
Yeah.
I didn't need to look at the Google Doc for that one.
So anyway, we're going to try to do it with those general parameters included. You can maybe just think of it as grit, maybe the grittiest college football coaches.
Yeah, maybe the grittiest.
We're all about grit here. And so we'll do a round robin style as usual with this, and we'll go down our lists. I didn't put mine in particular order. I don't know about you guys.
I did mine.
Okay, so we'll start with your number one then, Cooper.
Ooh, number one. Yeah, I picked Nick Saban. I think... in the conversation of just greatest college football coaches, not maybe necessarily grittiest college football coaches, I think the conversation boils down to pretty much Nick Saban and Urban Meyer. And I think Nick Saban is still like light years ahead of Urban Meyer in terms of college football coaches. And so even though I don't really like picking him because it's a very vanilla pick and I'm definitely not an SEC homer, I just can't pick anyone else.
Cooper, you left out a couple names there with the greatest college football coach of all time. Like, you know.
Oh, did I say all time? I meant to say active college football coaches. Thank you.
Oh, active. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll concede Urban Meyer is one of the better ones among the active coaches.
Yeah, sorry.
John was about to jump through the screen and punch you for not saying Newt Rockne.
Oh, no. Or all Frank time Leidy. College football coaches would be a different conversation.
We should do that next week.
Okay. Pencil that
in. John, what's your number one?
My number one is, I think it's pretty straightforward about who's got the most mental toughness. He's probably been in the most diversity of situations across his coaching career. He won in the pros, he's won in college. So yeah, Jim Harbaugh, the Khakis. He's probably the most mentally tough college football coach.
How?
Yeah.
Well, he stays dedicated to his schemes. He's, you know, he's played with Brady Hoke's players, which is really a horrific sentence if you think about it. Considering what Brady Hoke was.
In his tenure at Michigan, Brady Hoke was not the worst recruiter. Granted, Harbaugh's classes have been better, but it's not like Brady Hoke was recruiting outside the top 25.
Oh, but recruiting is one thing. Developing players is another thing, and that's the problem Brady Hoke had. And so I think Harbaugh managed to get as much out of these guys as was humanly possible. If you saw the way he coached the Michigan-Ohio State game this year, it was a miracle Ohio State won the game since Urban Meyer was playing so vanilla and so much like I don't want to lose. And in fact, Ohio State ended up only winning on a technicality at the end of the game.
Bold.
That I think it's clear that Jim Harbaugh is probably the most mentally tough college football coach. Also, I love the fact that he actually cares about his players and is taking them to Rome. That was pretty dope.
Yes. I mean, even as a huge Ohio State fan, I am very excited that Jim Harbaugh is the coach of Michigan and just a coach in the Big Ten. But I think it might be hard to stick the word mentally tough next to him when during his tenure at at Michigan, he has not produced a win against in like either of his two opportunities in the biggest game of the season for either team. And really just hasn't produced a big win in general. I think he's capable. Like, I think he is going to be a great coach. I'm very excited for him to be back in Michigan and kind of bring Michigan back to being a national power, but he just hasn't shown it yet. It's a work in progress.
All right, my number one, shout out Big 12, shout out the GOAT, Bill Snyder.
Yeah, not Bob Stoops.
Not Bob Stoops, no.
That's where I thought you were gone.
No, not Bob Stoops. Bob Stoops is not mentally tough.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't put him in that bucket. Probably wouldn't. But Bill Snyder on the other hand.
Probably not.
Bill Snyder, what he's done at Kansas State, taking them from just an absolute, like borderline a program that was like, could have been cut. Like they were a joke. And
like the other
team, yeah.
Kansas.
Uh-huh. But he's turned them into a perennially strong and occasionally great college football program. And he does it with, I think, a very understated, non-characteristic persona for college football coaches. He's not a rah-rah guy. He's pretty unflappable. And I think his teams reflect that.
Yeah, and he does it like, what? How old is he? Is he in his 80s?
That's a good question. I think he's either late 70s or in his 80s, yeah.
I like how he actually tries to play defense in that conference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had to look up where Lawrence, Kansas was. They're in Manhattan.
They're in Manhattan. The Little Apple, baby.
Yeah, the Little Apple. I knew that. Yeah, they went there for one of the great food truck races.
Of course. All right. Yeah. Cooper, what's your number two?
Yeah.
So, I mean, just the same kind of conversation before. I'm going to put Urban Meyer at number two. Once again, I don't necessarily know if he's the quote-unquote grittiest coach, but I think in order to be in the conversation of being the, you know, best active college football coach, you at least have to be somewhat mentally tough in order to build the right type of culture and create the wins and have the success that he does. I mean, he's, I think, currently the winningest college football coach in terms of winning percentage. So he slots into my number two.
Yeah, I think the fact that he turned tail and ran from the SEC and Nick Saban kind of disqualifies him a little bit.
And then beat him.
Well, I mean, he still ran away from Florida when he realized that Tebow wasn't coming back. I think that's a pretty bad mark against him. Oh, I'm going to take off some time and I'm going to spend it with my family.
I mean, he did, and he clearly had health problems that needed to be looked into. He was concerned about his health, his overall anxiety level. And yeah, I think it does kind of sort of take a mental toughness to recognize the fact that, like, to admit to yourself that maybe you do need some time away from the things that you love to do in order to kind of set your priorities straight. I think that kind of takes a different mental toughness, maybe one that we don't always recognize in a sport, especially like football.
I think also the way he handled his quarterback situation there was criminal when he's ruined JT Barrett, I think, as a passer.
I think that's incredibly ridiculous, but okay. We'll just wait until 2017 to prove me wrong.
Okay. My number two is Brian Kelly. I think if you look at that 2012 campaign, so like this last year would work against me, but I think up to this point.
Just this last year, you're right. Only this last year.
Well, no, just wait. Let me finish. So up until this point, one of Brian Kelly's hallmarks at Notre Dame was winning close games and was playing games solely to get the win at the end, not to win by a lot or whatever. And through his first 5 years here, that's what he did. Notre Dame got blown out playing Alabama and I think Arizona State, and that was it. Every other game was a tight game, and more often than not, we won them. I think being able to win tight games is an example of mental toughness. I think that game against Pittsburgh in 2012, where he took Everett Golson out of the game, put in Tommy Rees, and then put Everett back in with like, oh, and said, look, you're going to win the game, and you're going to win the game on the plays I call for you. And then we did. But that's, I think it's crazy. I think it's great.
Fair enough. You're entitled to your own opinion. My number two is Ed Orgeron, now coach of the LSU Tigers. If you just kind of look at his path, he's been the interim coach in like three different times. Most recently after Les Miles left this past year, was dismissed this past year. And it's done in situations that are obviously very difficult to kind of rally players around and keep the locker room. He's done that, as evidenced by LSU rewarding him with the full-time job. And I think in a conference like that, where every week is a battle, he's a guy that gets his team ready no matter what. And I think as an interim coach, head coach, full-time head coach, it doesn't matter. I would want to play for Ed Orgeron. He's also just a fantastic personality too. If you ever get a chance to like listen to it at a Coach O press conference, it is fantastic. All right, so we're getting a little long-winded here, and we're going to run through each of our final two fairly quickly. And why don't we each just do our two, and if anyone has any thoughts, they can chime in, and then we'll move on.
Okay, so I went with Chris Peterson at number three and Mark D'Antonio at number four. I think Mark D'Antonio is really the only coach on my list that actually fits maybe the mentally tough, gritty coach qualifier. I've always liked Mark D'Antonio. Always kind of scared to play his Michigan State teams.
John, you made a face with Cooper said.
Yeah, well, because my Mark D'Antonio memory is, I think in 2011 when he called a fake field goal in overtime against Notre Dame, instead of kicking the field goal to tie and go to a second overtime, he called the fake and ran the ball in for a touchdown. Yeah, and then he had a heart attack after the game, which is pretty crazy. It was a high stress situation, but that is my Mark D'Antonio mentally tough moment.
Yeah, probably, I would say that
was
like,
pretty mentally tough.
That's like a supporting that supports Cooper's point. I'm not really sure if that was what you're trying to do.
No, I was. It's a bad memory. It's a losing memory. So that was what the face was for. But last two is Dan Mullen, head coach of Mississippi State. He's had multiple opportunities to leave Starkville, but he's stayed. He groomed Dak Prescott and taught him how to be a quarterback, and now he's one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. And he has built up a program really from nothing. Like, I think he's been there maybe 7 years, and he's about to be the winningest football coach of all time in Starkville. So, and you can turn a program from nothing into a lot of something. I think that's a huge sign of mental toughness, especially when he doesn't leave and take other jobs. And my last one is Matt Rhule. He was formerly the head football coach at Temple University. He continued sort of the build that they had from actually absolute zero, where they were about to cut the football program, to now they're a pretty trendy pick a lot of the times. However, he's now the head football coach of Baylor, so he may not be the head football coach of anything much longer, since their football program should probably cease to exist.
All right, and my last two are James Franklin, the third one, head coach of Penn State. Very similar, I think, to the reasons Cooper had for Michigan State. His teams are just typically really difficult to play. They're well-disciplined, and obviously with the situation at Penn State being what it has been, I think he's done a great job of stable situation there. Obviously, they made the Rose Bowl last year, so it's a testament to how well he's done there. And then my number four is the newly minted head coach of Minnesota, PJ Fleck, who also is another guy who, if you get the chance to just like listen to him talk or like listen to the interview, is pretty compelling speaker, or really like a great motivator of people, I would say. Excited to see what he can do in the Big Ten. All right, we'll move on to another college football related segment. This is one we've also done before, but with a college football twist. It's the bandwagon. And looking again to college football season, however far away it may be, we are going to give some way too early Heisman picks. So whose Heisman bandwagon are you guys hopping on?
Why don't you start, Jeff?
I'll start. Sam Darnold at USC. He was a freshman quarterback last year. Then he didn't start for the entire season last year. He sat in the first three games as the backup and then came in and obviously led the USC to a great season. Obviously, we'll get the chance to start this year, and that team is going to be really good. And he made a name for himself in the Rose Bowl game last year, the name recognition is already there, so that helps his cause as much as anything when it comes to Heisman voting. But I'm pretty high on that. So Sam Darnold, lock it in.
Yeah, that's a treasonous pick there, Jeff. I think Sam Darnold's probably going to be good, maybe great, but I think his greatness lies more in the realm of Tommy Rees. In terms of statistics and it's a similar situation, yeah. Take over a team from an established starter, win your first bowl game. I think he's following that trajectory. Since we're talking about Heisman, I figured I'd bring up Heismanti, shout out. But my pick is Josh Adams. I think with a revamped Notre Dame offense and a re-energized Notre Dame Stadium with other running backs to back him up, but also a good, solid, cohesive offensive line and a pretty good passer, pretty good passing game with some excellent wide receivers for Brandon Wimbush to throw to. I think this is Josh Adams' year. I think he finally stays healthy for a full year and brings home the Heisman. He's an amazing runner. I love Josh Adams.
There could be a serious hurdle in his way, and that might be Brian Kelly's offense.
It's not Brian Kelly's offense anymore.
That's what they say.
No, he has gone on record saying he has given over all of the responsibilities for the offense to Chip Long.
All right. Anyways, it would have been very easy for me to pick JT Barrett. I'm not picking JT Barrett, not because I don't think he's going to have a great season, but I think Ohio State's offense is going to look very balanced this year. And also, I think being a senior actually hurts him in terms of just actually winning the Heisman, which actually, as I'm saying, that sounds ridiculous. Because I am going, Saquon Barkley. He's going to be a junior. Perfect. That's who I'm going with. Saquon Barkley, I think, if you get a chance to watch Penn State play, is a very dynamic athlete, not just running back, has the ability to catch the ball out of the backfield too. Insanely athletic. And I kind of think that Penn State's actually ability to pass the ball this season will help them out a lot in terms of the running game. I also just want to throw out Shane Buechele. I think he showed last season that he is definitely a capable passer. I think Tom Herman's only going to be an asset.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Offensive system can't hurt him.
Maybe kind of like a sleeper pick.
So, yeah, definitely hold us to those, especially the Josh Adams one. As you were saying, I was trying to think of something I would commit to doing if Josh Adams won the Heisman.
Listener suggestions.
Please. Yeah.
Yeah, let me know.
Jeff, I've already won one bet.
That's true. The Sixers hit that wins total over. So I owe John a six pack of adult beverages. But that's not
there we go.
Neither here nor there. We'll move on to the last segment, the segment we close each week with, the waste of data. This one should hopefully be a little more tame, a little less tense than last week's because we got a little heated, I would say.
Just a little.
So John, we'll start with you.
Okay, so mine is Doris Burke. I had the great misfortune of listening to Doris Burke be the commenter for the women's Final Four game Mississippi State was playing in against UConn. And I was reminded that she's a very bad basketball commentator. Not only that, she's also a very partisan basketball commentator, which is normally fine because you get Dickie V is normally pretty partisan for Duke. And that's acceptable because of how he spins it. And Rebecca Lobos, who also does commentary for the women's basketball, is generally pretty in the tank for either UConn or Stanford. But it's fine, again, because of how she spins it. Doris Burke does a very bad job of it. She needs to go back to just doing regular season NBA games because that seems to be her forte. She knows next to nothing about college basketball. My favorite Doris Burke moment of all time is when she spent the entirety of a game between Temple and Syracuse gushing about Michael Carter Williams while Syracuse managed to lose by 20 points to Temple University. She's terrible. Get her out of the Final Four. She does not belong anywhere near the national championship game.
So was she, in your opinion, in the bag for UConn?
Oh, yeah. It was. She was very condescending towards the entire state of Mississippi, additionally. So.
All right, fair enough. Cooper.
Yeah, I think this is more just, I think, depressing than something that I'm angry about. Recently, the Chicago Fire acquired Bastian Schweinsteiger, formerly of Manchester United and before that of Germany, and actually had a very impressive start to his MLS career. He scored a goal.
He did.
Anyways, in his, you know, kind of in the ceremony that, you know, to induct Schweinsteiger, to welcome Schweinsteiger, you know, into the Chicago Fire and into the MLS, a reporter asked him if there was a clear path to the World Cup for the Chicago Fire. And for those of you who don't know, the Chicago Fire as a club team, it's not even possible. It's just ridiculous. They cannot play in the World Cup. That is for international teams alone. And I doubt, based off how the World Cup, I mean, how the reporter was saying it, that the reporter was alluding to the, you know, Club World Cup. And that's ridiculous too. So I just don't. It's just embarrassing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and they asked him multiple times too. They repeated the question back to him.
For whatever reason, I imagine this reporter being like John Oliver. But it seems like it should be satire.
Yeah, it should be satire. But it's not.
Bad. That's terrible. My waste of data to wrap it up, Major League Baseball, because it's super trendy and in touch with the millennials, has a hashtag for each team. And if you do that hashtag, then that team's logo comes up. And some of them are awful. You have, my favorite, the worst, is That's Cub for the Cubs. That's Cub. Let's see here. I'm looking. Who's Your Tiger is another very strong candidate.
What's the Phillies?
Phillies is Go Phils. Simple, understated, elegant. Like it.
I've used that one before.
Nothing wrong with that. Let's Go Fish for the Marlins is the third one that I'll round out. But if you want to look at some of the others, there's a bunch of them. And
some of them are super creative. Hashtag like Reds.
The Reds have a fantastic one.
Hashtag Astros.
Hashtag Nats. Yeah, you can tell who was like missed the deadline to turn theirs in. It was like, oh, crap, we have to put in a hashtag. But I do like the Red Sox. Win, dance, repeat. Hopefully we'll be seeing a lot of that this year. But yeah, these were just kind of funny and how silly some of them were. So keep doing what you're doing, Major League Baseball. You're really connecting with us millennials. And that's the show for the week. Thank you guys for tuning in yet again. We hope you enjoyed this week. We hope you've enjoyed prior week's episodes as well. If you have thoughts, if you have suggestions, leave us a review on our iTunes page, or you can reach us at any of our social media pages, Instagram, Twitter, at Small Takes, Facebook, All the Small Takes, and Gmail, allthesmalltakes@gmail.com. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. And until then.
Dope.